Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much, Stephen. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to join this annual dinner of the ABE. I've spoken at this dinner three times before, in 2010, 2012 and 2014, so thank you for inviting me back. It's a great privilege to be here. I want to also thank Stephen Hamowrick for the 9 years of service of leadership of the ABE. You've done a fantastic job, and they've been nine interesting years in the global economy, so thanks for your effort here. And Bill Evans, thanks for your 20 years of service. It's a long time. And I'd like to also welcome the teachers here tonight, because my own interest in economics started when I was in high school in Wagga Wagga. And it started because I had a fantastic economics teacher who was able to bring the subject alive for me. And I liked it so much that I wanted to come to the Reserve Bank straight from high school. And it was all because of the fantastic teaching that I had. So the teachers do a wonderful job in stimulating the future supply of economists. So thank you, and thanks for coming along tonight. When I spoke at this dinner in 2012, the title of my remarks was "What is Normal?" On that occasion, I talked about a recalibration of expectations about what was considered normal in the Australian economy. I also suggested that the normal level of interest rates might be lower than it was in the past. 5 years on, though, we're still searching for what is normal. In a number of countries, low rates of unemployment are coexisting with below average inflation. Low inflation, in turn, means low interest rates. And many investors judge that this unusual combination of low unemployment and low inflation can persist for quite some time. Perhaps it's the new normal. And with inflation rates having surprised on the downside for a few years now, there's an unusually low compensation for future inflation risk in many financial prices. Real income growth for many households has also been unusually slow in many countries. Not surprisingly, these households, including many here in Australia, wonder whether this slow growth in incomes is now also the new normal, or whether in time it too will pass. And much depends upon the answer to this, including households' appetite and ability to spend and to borrow. So in these areas, we're still searching for what is normal. Tonight, I'd like to use this opportunity to reflect on some of the questions that we've been grappling at the RBA over the past year or so that I've had the privilege of being the governor. And a number of these questions go to what would be considered normal these days. I'm not able to give you a full suite of answers, but I do hope you find the transparency around our thinking useful. There are three sets of questions that have occupied much of our time over the past year. The first is how the final stages of the transition to lower levels of mining investment would play out. The second is the degree to which an improving labour market would translate into a pickup in wages growth and inflation. And the third is the nature of the risks stemming from the high and rising levels of household indebtedness and how we should deal with those risks. So tonight I'd like to talk about each of those three issues and then conclude with how they've influenced the board's decisions on monetary policy over the past year. For a number of years, we've been describing the Australian economy as being in transition, a transition from very high levels of mining investment to something more normal. It's now time to move on to a new narrative. As you can see, I hope, from this first chart, the wind down of mining investment is now all but complete, with work soon to be finished on some of the large LNG projects. So mining investment as a share of GDP is now back to something more normal. And this means, as that I talked about in a recent speech in Perth, it's time to open a new chapter in Australia's economic story. Over recent times, our judgment has been that this transition to lower levels of mining investment was masking an underlying improvement in our economy. It was masking this improvement because the decline in mining investment was generating substantial negative spillovers to the rest of the economy. These spillovers were most evident in Queensland and Western Australia, where for a while growth in employment, investment and incomes were all very weak. The good news is that these negative spillovers from lower levels of mining investment are now fading. As you can see here in this chart, which shows employment growth, this improvement was first evident in Queensland, where the labour market began to improve in 2015. But it's now evident in Western Australia too, where conditions in the labour market have improved noticeably since late last year. And as you can see elsewhere, there's been steady growth in employment for quite a few years now. The fading of these negative spillovers is one reason why growth in the Australian economy is expected to strengthen over the period ahead. Another is increased resource exports as a result of all the mining investment that's taken place. So we expect GDP growth to pick up to be a bit above average, to average a bit above 3% over 2018 and 2019. As you can see, if these forecasts were to be realised, it would represent a better outcome than we've achieved for some years now. This more positive outlook is being supported by an improving world economy, by low interest rates, by strong population growth, and by increased spending on infrastructure. All these things are helping. Encouragingly, the outlook for business investment has brightened recently. For a number of years, we were repeatedly disappointed that non-mining business investment was not picking up. Part of the explanation was the negative spillover effects that I just spoke about, although, as my colleague Guy Debelle spoke about last week, there are other factors at work as well. Now, though, a gentle upswing in business investment does seem to be taking place, and the forward indicators suggest that this will continue. I think it's too early to say that animal spirits have returned with gusto, but more firms are reporting that economic conditions have improved and more are now prepared to take a risk and invest in new assets, and this is good news for the economy. The improvement in the business environment is also reflected in strong employment growth, as you can see in this chart here. Over the past year, the number of people with jobs in Australia has increased by around 3%. That's the fastest increase for some time. The pickup in jobs is evident across the country, and it's been strongest in household services and construction industries. It's also leading to a pickup in labour force participation, especially for women. So business is feeling better than it has for some time, and it's lifting capital spending, and it's creating more jobs. That's good news. At the same time, though, growth in consumer spending remains fairly soft. Indeed, for a number of years, consumption growth has been weaker than we had originally forecast. You can see this in this chart, which shows our forecast for consumption growth at various points in time, as well as the actual outcome, which is shown in the black line. And the picture's pretty clear. For some years, consumption growth has been weaker than forecast, and it's not exceeded 3% for quite a few years, whereas before the financial crisis, it was regularly above 3%. The most likely explanation for the ongoing subdued consumption outcomes is a combination of weak growth in real household income and high levels of household debt. Given the persistence of these factors, our latest forecasts have incorporated a flatter profile for consumption than we have seen in previous forecasts. And you can see that there in the forecast for the next couple of years for consumption growth being around 3%. So an important factor that's going to shape the future is how these cross-cutting themes are resolved. Businesses feel better than they have for some time, and they're investing and employing people. But consumers feel weighed down by weak income growth and high debt levels. Our central scenario is that increased willingness of business to invest and to employ people will lead to a gradual increase in the growth of consumer spending. As employment increases, so too will household income, and some increase in wage growth will also support household incomes. Given these factors, the central forecast is for consumption growth to pick up a bit over the next little while. This would be above the average of past decade, but it would be below the average of the period before the financial crisis. I'd like now to turn to the second question that has occupied us over much of the past year, and that's the degree to which an improving labour market will translate into a pickup in wages growth and ultimately inflation. A distinguishing feature of Australia's recent economic performance has been slow growth in wages. You see that here. The wage price index has increased by just 2% over the past year. In earlier years, Australians had got used to average wage increases of around the 3.5% to 4% mark, but now 2% to 2.5% is the norm. Growth in average hourly earnings has been weaker than this. In trend terms, it's running at the lowest rate since the 1960s. Not only are wage increases low, but people have been moving out of high-paying mining jobs into lower-paying jobs elsewhere in the economy. And we've also heard reports through our liaison program that there's been some downward pressure on non-wage payments, including allowances, and there's been an increase in the proportion of new employees hired on lower salaries than their predecessors. As I noted earlier, subdued growth in wages is also occurring in a number of other countries. Understanding this is a major priority. Low growth in wages means low inflation, which means low interest rates, which means high asset valuations. So a lot depends on understanding the reasons for slow growth in nominal and real wages. In my view, the answers are likely to be found in a combination of cyclical and structural factors. In Australia, we're still some way short of our estimate of full employment of around 5%, so it's not surprising that wage growth is a bit below average at the moment. But I think structural factors are also at work, and foremost amongst these are perceptions of increased competition. Many workers feel there's more competition out there, sometimes from workers overseas and sometimes because of advances in technology. In the past, these pressures of competition from globalisation and from technology were felt most acutely by workers in the manufacturing industry. But now these same forces of competition are being felt in an increasingly wide range of service industries. This shift, together with changes in the nature of work and in bargaining arrangements, mean that many workers feel like they have less bargaining power than they once did. But this is not the full story. It's likely there's something happening on the firm side as well. In other advanced economies where unemployment rates are below conventional estimates of full employment, the normal tendency for firms to pay higher wages in tight labour markets appears to be quite muted. Businesses are not bidding up wages in the way they might once have in tight labour markets. And this is partly because businesses too feel the pressure of increased competition. One response to this competitive pressure is to have a laser-like focus on reducing costs. Over recent times, there's been a mindset in many businesses, including some here in Australia, that the key to higher profits is to reduce costs, and paying higher wages considered odds with that mindset. Given these various effects of competition, it's plausible that at least for a while, the economy is less inflation prone than it once was. Both workers and firms feel more competition, and it's plausible that the wage and price setting processes in the economy have changed in response to this. This, of course, does not mean that the normal forces of supply and demand have been abandoned. Tighter labour markets should still push up wages and prices, even if it takes a little longer than we've become used to. And we're starting to see some hints of this in the Australian labour market now. As you can see in this chart, business service surveys report that firms are having more difficulty finding suitable labour than they have for some time. It's the orange line here. In the past, when firms found it difficult to find suitable labour, higher growth in wages followed. Consistent with this, we are hearing reports through our liaison program that in some pockets, the stronger demand for workers is starting to push wages up a bit. And we expect that as employment growth continues, these reports will become a bit more common. Another factor that's having a significant bearing on the outlook for inflation is increased competition in the retail industry. I spoke a few moments ago about how globally increased competition is affecting the pricing dynamics, and Australian retailing provides a very good example of this. Competition from new entrants is putting pressure on margins, and it's forcing existing businesses to find ways to lower their cost structures. Technology is helping them do this, including by automating processes and streamlining logistics, and the result is lower prices. As is evident here, for some years now, the rate of increase in food prices has been unusually low. A large part of the story here is increased competition. The same story is now playing out in other parts of retailing. Over recent times, the prices of many consumer goods, including clothing, furniture, and household appliances, have all been falling. So increased competition and changes in technology are driving down the prices of many of the things that we buy. This is making for a tough environment for many of those in the retail industry, but for consumers, lower prices are good news. A question we are grappling with here is how much further this process has to run. It's difficult to know the answer, but our sense is that the impact of greater competition on consumer prices still has some way to go as both retailers and wholesalers adjust their business models in Australia. So this is likely to be a constraining factor on inflation for a while yet. Putting all this together, we expect inflation to pick up, but to do so only gradually. And you can see that here. By the end of our two-year forecast period, inflation is expected to reach about 2% in underlying terms and a little higher in headline terms because of the planned increases in tobacco excise. And underpinning this expected but gradual lift in inflation is a gradual increase in wage growth in response to the tighter labour market. The third question we focused on over recent times is implications of high and rising level of household debt. The growth of household debt has been outpacing the very slow growth in household incomes for a few years now, and as a result, the household debt-to-income ratio has risen. Although if you take account of the increased balances held in offset accounts, the rise is less pronounced. You can see that in the dotted lines here. The low level of interest rates means that even though the debt levels are higher, the share of household income devoted to paying mortgage interest is lower than it has been for some time, as you can see on the right-hand side. Perhaps reflecting this, as well as the recent decline in the unemployment rate, aggregate indicators of household financial stress in Australia remain quite low. The central issue here is how the high levels of debt affect the stability of our economy over the medium term. Our concern has not been the stability of the banking system. The banks are strong and they're well capitalised. Rather, the concern has been that as the household sector takes on ever more debt relative to its income, the risk of medium-term problems increases. And this is especially so when much of this debt has been taken on in an unusually low interest rate environment. It's difficult to be precise about exactly how much the risk has increased, but our judgment has been that should the earlier trends have continued, the risk of future problems would have continued to rise. A scenario we are focused on is the possibility of a future shock that causes households to abruptly reassess their past borrowing decisions. In this scenario, consumption might be wound back sharply to put the household balance sheets on a firmer footing. If this occurred, it could turn an otherwise manageable shock into something that was much more serious. Now, one way of guarding against this risk is for lenders to maintain very strong lending standards. The various steps taken by APRA, with the strong support of the Council of Financial Regulators, have worked in this direction. Growth in lending to investors has slowed. Fewer loans are being made with very high LVRs. Debt servicing tests have been tightened, and fewer interest-only loans are now being made. The latest data suggests that banks have more than succeeded in reducing interest-only lending to below the 30% benchmark. That's evident in this chart. These are all positive developments, but it's an area that we, together with the Council of Financial Regulators, continue to watch very carefully. Recently, we've also seen some cooling in the Sydney property market. This reflects a combination of factors, including increased supply of new dwellings, some tightening of credit conditions, higher interest rates on loans to investors, and some reduction in offshore demand. The increasing unaffordability of prices for many prices has also probably played a role here. In Melbourne, where the population is growing very strongly, housing prices are still increasing faster than incomes, although the rate of increase has slowed recently. Elsewhere, housing prices have been little changed over recent months. Conditions are subdued in Brisbane, where the supply of apartments has increased, and prices remain weak in Perth. It's important to be clear that the RBA does not have a target for housing prices. But a return to more sustainable growth in housing prices does reduce the medium-term risks facing our economy. These risks have not gone away, but the fact that they are not building at the rate they have been is another positive development. I'd now like to conclude with what all this has meant for monetary policy over the past year or so. As you're aware, the Reserve Bank Board has kept the cash rate unchanged at 1.5% since August last year. In the early part of that period, a central issue was balancing the need to support the economy in the final days of the transition to lower levels of mining investment against the risks stemming from the rising household debt. Lower interest rates over this period might have provided a bit more support, but they would have done so partly by encouraging people to borrow yet more money, thus adding to the risks. The board's judgment that this would not have been consistent with its broad mandate for economic stability. Accordingly, with the economy expected to pick up and the unemployment rate expected to come down gradually as the mining transition came to an end, the board judged that it was appropriate to hold the cash rate at 1.5%. We were prepared to be patient in the interests of medium-term economic stability. As the year progressed, we became somewhat more confident that the expected pickup in growth would materialise. The strengthening in the global economy has helped here. So too has the lift in employment and the better outlook for investment. This improvement meant that the case for lower interest rates weakened as the year progressed. Also, as the year progressed, one issue the board paid increasing attention to was the persistently weak growth in wages and household incomes and the implications of this for consumption. A related issue is the effect of increase in competition on the wage and price dynamics. As I said earlier, we're still trying to understand this. It does, though, look increasingly likely that these factors will mean that inflation remains subdued for some time yet. We still expect headline inflation to move above 2% on a sustained basis, but it's taking a bit longer to get there than we had earlier expected. So in summary, over the past year or so, there's been progress in moving the economy closer to full employment and in having inflation return to the 2-3% range. Both of these are positive developments and suggest a more familiar normal is closer in sight. Progress on these fronts have been made while also containing a build-up of risks in household balance sheets. We still, though, remain short of full employment, and inflation is expected to pick up only gradually and remain below average for some time. This means that a continuation of accommodative monetary policy is appropriate. Having said that, if the economy continues to improve as expected, it's more likely that the next move in interest rates will be up rather than down. But the continuing spare capacity in the economy and the subdued outlook for inflation mean that there is not a strong case for a near-term adjustment in monetary policy. And we will, of course, continue to keep that judgment under review. So thank you all very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Phil, for that very thought-provoking and detailed speech. We really appreciate, we know a lot of effort goes into those speeches and appreciate you coming here tonight. Phil has been very generous in agreeing to take questions, so we've got a couple of microphones on either side of the room. When you ask a question, please state your name and your affiliation and keep your questions both relevant and brief. So why don't we...
Hi, Adam Donaldson from Commonwealth Bank. You obviously focused a lot in the talk on household debt and consumption and some of the weakness on that front, but also on the need for financial stability and the steps that have been taken, for example, to lower interest-only loans. I guess what I'm wondering is, to what extent do you think shifting people from interest-only loans to principal and interest, or alternatively, seeing a variety of bank customers facing higher interest-only interest rates, has taken cash flow out of households' pockets and may be contributing to the softness that we're seeing in consumption and perhaps some of that retail story at the moment.
Yeah, I don't think the higher interest rates on interest-only loans are the reason that we have soft retail numbers. You know, if you step back from kind of the flow of the monthly data, it wasn't that long ago that 40 to 50% of new loans being made in Australia did not require the repayment of $1 of principal on a regular basis. When I talk to my colleagues overseas, they say, that's just crazy. You know, how could you allow that? And we came to the view through the Council of Financial Regulators as that was not a good position for the Australian mortgage market to be in. So I think structurally reducing the dependence on interest-only loans was the right decision. It's meaning that the banks have sounder mortgage portfolios and people will build up buffers gradually over time. So there's still a role for interest-only lending in the Australian mortgage market, but we surely didn't need 40 to 50% of new mortgages not requiring a repayment of any principal. So I think this has been a successful public policy intervention. I say to some of the banks, well, why? Because a number of the banks have said, well, to me, well, this is a good move, thank you. We felt slightly uncomfortable with the previous set of arrangements. And I say back, well, why didn't you do something about it? And it's interesting because there's a coordination problem. No one really wants to step back from a market kind of way of doing it, the way that everyone else is doing things, because if you do it, the analyst community might penalise you because you lose market share. So I really see what the Council of Financial Regulators and APRA has done is solve a coordination problem and moving the whole system to actually better equilibrium. It would have been much better if the banks themselves, the lenders themselves, had moved to a better equilibrium, but they didn't. In the end, we thought it was the right thing to do to help the whole system move to a better equilibrium. I think we've done that.
Governor, I'm interested in the comment in the minutes today about the challenge of managing risks associated with high and rising household debt, and you talked about it in your speech today. We're in a situation now where the reason why household leverage is rising is very much to do with weak income growth rather than necessarily than accelerating credit growth. In fact, I think it's reasonable to say that household credit growth that was 6% in 17 is likely to be lower next year. We estimate it to be about 4.5% with the heat coming out of the housing market and banks' lending guidelines remaining tight. So if you do have a rise in leverage next year, mainly because you still can't close that gap between income growth and credit growth, but credit growth is in fact slowing, do you see that as a risk? Leverage is rising, but it's rising for reasons that we shouldn't really think in terms of threatening to the economy because credit growth is slowing down. What's your opinion on that?
Well, we don't have a target for credit growth, but I think housing credit growth of 6% is sustainable. So I suspect over time income growth will pick up and housing credit growth of 6% in a low interest rate environment is perfectly understandable. We were concerned a number of years back when investor loan growth was 12% and APRA had the restrictions. So I think 6% is okay, particularly in an environment in which income growth is gradually picking up. The key is to making sure that the banks have strong lending standards, and they have been increasing those. The reduction in interest-only lending, I think, is part of that. There's been a substantial decline in the share of loans with LVRs above 90 and even a decline in between 80 and 90. So the lending seems sounder than it was a number of years back. There's also been tightening up in the income test the banks use, and Wayne Byers in a speech yesterday said there might be more scope for tightening up in the calculations about net income surplus. So I think that's probably the next area to look at. But the new loans being made today feel better credit quality than the ones being made 3 years ago. And while ever that's the case, I think credit growth of 6% sustainable, particularly if income growth picks up.
Oh, hi, Tim Perridge, State Street. The RBNZ are moving to a dual mandate to look at inflation targeting and also a growth component. What do you think of that, and what would that mean if the RBA moved in that direction? Thanks.
Well, we're already in that direction. I mean, the Reserve Bank Act was written in 1959, and it sets out three objectives: effectively price stability, full employment, and the economic prosperity of the Australian people. So we have three kind of very broad objectives. That type of broad mandate became unfashionable in the world of central banking over the past couple of decades, where many central banks moved to an inflation-only mandate. I'm strongly of the view that that's actually the wrong approach, that we're much better off with our kind of old-fashioned mandate in Australia: price stability, full employment, and the economic prosperity of the people of Australia. So that's the right mandate, and we've been able to run an effective monetary policy with that mandate, and as I said in my remarks, we've pursued inflation, getting inflation up, but in a way that's also preserved economic stability, and we haven't been, as I've said on previous occasions, inflation nutters to kind of get inflation up quickly, and it's because we've got this broad mandate. So I think in practice a change in New Zealand is they wouldn't have run that, their monetary policy wouldn't have been that much different. But I like our old-fashioned 1959 mandate. I think it's the right mandate for central banks, because ultimately what we're trying to do is deliver price stability in the context of delivering overall economic stability and economic prosperity, and that's the frame of reference. Inflation is a way of delivering economic prosperity, but also full employment is part of that equation. So I really feel this kind of inflation, full employment, and economic prosperity is the right mandate for central banks.
We'll just go right up the back. Have you got a microphone down the back there? We'll just here. Sorry, we'll go here first and then we'll go down there.
Hi, Phil. In considering the outlook for house prices, there obviously is a focus on Sydney and Melbourne, and there seems to be a bit of a debate about whether Victoria is actually oversupplied or undersupplied. And there was some recent research from the ANU suggesting that overall the Australian housing market is oversupplied in parts of Melbourne. I'm just wondering whether you might want to comment on housing supply-demand balances.
Yeah, we shouldn't really talk about the Australian housing market, should we? Because, you know, over the last period since 2000, the ratio of house prices to income in Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, Hobart, they've moved up and down, but they haven't had any trend in them. So the ratio of house prices to income hasn't really moved anywhere for a decade and a half. But in Sydney and Melbourne, the ratio of house prices to income have moved up a lot. So it's really been a Sydney and Melbourne story, and Sydney's now calming down. And it's kind of interesting why that's happening. When I talk to my colleagues in other central banks, they're noticing a similar phenomenon in some of their countries, where you've got one or two cities where the house prices to income ratios have stepped up a lot, and in most other cities in the country that hasn't occurred. And one explanation is that there's growth in the superstar cities, that for some reason the economic or social returns to living in specific cities has risen, and people are prepared to pay higher prices to live in those cities. And Sydney and Melbourne are two of those cities: Auckland, Vancouver, Toronto, Stockholm, Amsterdam, San Francisco. For some reason, people are prepared to pay a lot more to live in those cities. And I think that's basically what's been happening. Low interest rates have added to that, but it's basically people prepared to pay a lot more to live in certain cities. And we don't fully understand why that is, but it's a common thing across the world. In Melbourne, it's hard to tell about the supply-demand dynamics. The population, though, in Melbourne is growing at 3% a year. So, you know, that's incredibly fast. In 3 years' time, there'll be nearly 10% more people living in Melbourne. You need to build a lot of housing to cope with that. And I suspect that, you know, while there might be some pockets in Melbourne of excess supply, it's very unlikely that Melbourne will find itself with too many dwellings with the population growing at 3% a year. The area of kind of where there's kind of excess supply is really in the Brisbane inner city apartment market. I think that's the clearest example. But elsewhere, I don't really have major concerns about the supply-demand imbalance.
Hi, it's Rory Robertson from Westpac Group. Governor Lowe, thanks for another fascinating talk. One of the big issues in society these days is wealth inequality, and I'd like to congratulate the Reserve Bank for actually participating in this debate in a way it may not have in earlier times. In July, at a Q&A event somewhat like this one, you told a journalist matter-of-factly that wealth inequality has become more pronounced, particularly over the past 5 or 6 years, because we've seen some big gains in asset prices, things like house prices, commercial property prices, more recently share prices. And you said, so the people who own the assets, who tend to be wealthy people, have seen their wealth go up. One of the questions that many people are asking, and I'm asking tonight, is if increased wealth inequality is a bad thing, why is it supported by Reserve Bank policy, in that at a time of strong jobs growth, historically low unemployment of 5.4%, I wonder if you could discuss further, please, how the Reserve Bank balances its concerns about increasing wealth inequality, rising household debt and reduced housing affordability with its policy choice of promoting precisely those outcomes via the lowest borrowing rates that many of Australians have ever seen.
Well, it's certainly true that low interest rates have pushed up asset prices, and that benefits most of the people who own the assets. That's how it works. But the other thing, and actually the more important thing that low interest rates have done, is means that more people have jobs. Just run the counterfactual experiment. If the cash rate today wasn't 1.5%, it was 3.5%. Do you really think the unemployment rate would be 5.4% and we would have had 3% employment growth over the past year? I don't think so. We'd have had a lot of people who didn't have jobs. The economy would be in a very stressed situation. So the low interest rates have had this effect on asset prices, but the more important thing from my perspective is a lot more Australians have jobs, and that ultimately contributes to economic equality, and that's the most important thing we can do. So I don't think you could have the kind of jobs without the higher asset prices. So they kind of go together. But the most important thing is a lot of people have jobs and they have income that they wouldn't otherwise have had. So I think you've got to be kind of careful what the counterfactual is here.
Kumar Palghat from Capstream Capital. Technology and computers are taking such a big role where they're replacing human beings in doing most of the work, which to me says that the world we live in is in a deflationary environment. Human beings then have to retrain themselves to do something else. How does the central bank then deal with a situation where you live in a world where there's no inflation and there's high unemployment? Because you have to train yourself to do something else, and you got to eventually figure out what you want to do because there's no inflation. What does a central bank policy look like in that environment where there's no inflation and high unemployment?
Well, I would take an issue with the premise of the question, really, that there's high unemployment. If you look at the US, Germany, Japan, the UK, the average unemployment rate in those economies is the lowest in 3 decades, in some cases 4 decades. I was at in Basel the weekend before last, and Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, saying the unemployment rate in the UK is the lowest in 42 years. In the US, it's very, very low. In Japan, you know, it's 2.7%. So technology is changing the nature of jobs, but it actually, in net terms, it's not destroying jobs. It's creating new jobs, and I think that's going to remain the case. So the issue is not that there is a lack of jobs, it's the lack of income growth that's going with those jobs. I think that's the more pressing issue, and I think we see this in Australia. The unemployment rate, it's reasonably low. It would be good to have it lower, but it's still reasonably low. But it's not just that there's not generating the wage growth that we once saw, and we're seeing this in country after country after country, and I think it's indirectly the effects of technology affecting competition. So this is the world we're in is actually low unemployment and low inflation. It's much better than 1970s, isn't it? Remember, there we had high unemployment and high inflation. So it's a much better world to be in. The important thing is that people have jobs, and I think over time, and this is part of our strategy, the strengthening of the labour market will see the demand-supply balance shift and wage growth will pick up. So my concern really is the lack of wage growth, not the lack of jobs from technology. I think there will be plenty of jobs. They'll just be different ones, and we'll have to train to have them, but there will be jobs.
Sophia Rodriguez from Market News. I'm a numbers person, but I spend the entire weekend with my calculator trying to get 15 or 17.5. 2 months back, you said that in your 7-year term, you will get us an inflation close to 2.5. And we have 1.8, we will get 1.8 again, probably 1.92. It doesn't add up to 15 or 17.5. Would you get impatient?
Well, inflation is already up. Remember, it troughed 6 months ago, and so inflation has already risen, and I think within the year, headline inflation will be back above 2%. So my basic job over my term is to deliver the community an average rate of inflation between 2 and 3%, with low unemployment and economic stability, and I'm confident we can do that. And we're not getting back to 2.5% inflation as quickly as we would have otherwise liked. I said the only way that we could get back more quickly is to have yet lower interest rates, and that would have encouraged people to borrow even more, which would have reduced the chances of economic stability going forward. So I think we'll get there. It's just taking a bit longer than we'd hoped.
Thank you.
We'll just go to Matt and then down the back.
Matt Sheward, Perpetual Investments. Thanks very much for your comments, Dr. Lowe. I was intrigued that you said one of your concerns was households stepping back their spending growth to deal with their balance sheet, and this is what you're weighing up with your policy decisions. It creates an interesting dynamic in the sense that households individually believe they're behaving rationally, but collectively as a sector they're behaving irrationally because precautionary savings rise, economic growth slows, and of course unemployment goes up. Yeah. So were that to eventuate, would you see a greater role for other stabilisation tools such as the exchange rate and fiscal policy to take the slack and to help you guys stabilise what would be a very difficult economic terrain for the country, having never had a recession in 26 years?
Well, in that scenario, you'd want all guns firing, wouldn't you? You'd want monetary stimulus, perhaps fiscal stimulus, a lower currency, and those things would help stabilise the economy. I think it's the probability of us ending in that situation is quite low, but if we do, then we have policy scoped and the exchange rate has the flexibility. So, our economy has tremendous flexibility. I mean, if you just think of the period since 91, we've had tremendous shocks, biggest terms of trade, biggest rise in mining investment in a century, a global financial crisis, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Yet we've had some ups and downs, but we've basically got through that, and it's because of the flexibility in our economy, the flexibility in the labour market, the exchange rate, the flexibility we've had with monetary policy and with fiscal policy. So you can think of scenarios that kind of where we get hit by bad shocks, but we've got to remember we have a lot of flexibility in this economy, and it's served us well. And I can't see why that wouldn't be the case in the future.
Phil, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. Just bringing you back to the low unemployment and weak wage growth, I'm just wondering how much of that is linked to the rise of or the growth of part-time employment, and is that becoming something of an X factor in this scene that we're seeing?
Again, I don't think that's the primary thing, because this is something that's happening in country after country after country. And we haven't seen the same shift of between full-time, part-time employment in lots of other countries. There are broad across-country explanations at work, and I think it's coming down to this perception of competition from both workers and firms. In some sense, the kind of the distinction between part-time and full-time employment is a bit old-fashioned. I know in my own organisations, many people actually want to work part-time, and they do. So probably many of your organisations, well, for many, many years, some people have wanted to work part-time and the old-fashioned employers haven't allowed it. And now it's possible and people are responding, and so many people, in fact, the vast bulk of people who work part-time want to work part-time. And most of them are pretty happy with the hours they work. They're sure there's some that want more hours, but the vast bulk of people who are working part-time want to work part-time and broadly happy with the hours they work. So I don't think that's the explanation for the weak wage growth in country after country after country.
Good evening, Dr. Lowe. Thank you. Jill Lawrence from the Australian Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman's Office. It is the catchiest name in the room. You've used the word bank quite frequently this evening. I was just inquiring if the Reserve Bank has the granularity of their research to understand the different resources, access to capital, they're offering to markets between our four majors, no offence to our four major representatives here this evening, the second tier banks and the customer owned banks. What your policies mean to those different levels of licence holders and how they impact their future offerings to their customer base.
Well, we're looking very carefully at the shifting structure in the financial system, and there's been an increase in the share of housing lending by the banks who aren't the large four. So there has been a gradual shift over recent times to lending other than through the big four, and many of the smaller institutions have some type of competitive advantage either through their close relationship with their customers or other strategic advantages. So that we kind of watch what's going on there, but our policies don't directly affect that. Now, remember, we set the overnight interest rate. So our policies don't really affect institutions differentially. But it is interesting, there's a shift back to smaller lenders. And partly it's because the restrictions from APRA are more binding on the large institutions. They were the ones who had more interest-only loans and often with more interest, more investor loans. So the restrictions have affected the large institutions a bit more than the smaller ones.
Governor Lowe, Carrington Clark from the ABC. If I can take you back to the conundrum of low wages growth, would an income tax cut help to solve the problem of low wages growth and help to give us some inflation?
I don't think so. You might want to have income tax cuts for other reasons, but I don't think it's the solution to low wage growth. Because if you look at what's going in country after country, you see there's kind of some global international factors at work. So we can often look for Australian-specific explanations, and sometimes there are Australian-specific explanations, but I spent a lot of time overseas talking to governors and other central banks, and they're grappling with exactly the same issues that we're grappling with here. So for me, the underlying explanations are really global in nature, and we can do things kind of domestically, but really there are these global factors that are very structural and very pervasive. You might want tax cuts for other reasons, but it's... Just got one idea.
Governor Lowe, thank you very much for your remarks tonight. Tanya Bramwhite from the Future Fund. My question is that your address today highlighted the challenge of trying to understand cyclical versus secular change. And my question to you is, if we were to roll forward 5 years from now and still were looking back saying that inflation has underestimated our expectations, would the focus of the Reserve Bank in terms of policy, notwithstanding that you have three different elements of policy to focus on, would that change if that was to be the outcome?
Well, it's hard to know that. I mean, as I said, we've had these objectives since 1959, and they've served us through very different regimes. And I think there'd be a strong case to keep those kind of broad objectives of the central bank. I'm confident we'll be able to deliver for you an average rate of inflation of 2 point something. You know, we're not that far away from that at the moment, and the economy is picking up. And we are seeing some pockets of stronger labour market pressures putting upward pressure on wages. So we're not too far away from 2%, and I think we'll get there. We're just not getting there as quickly as we would like to. I think we can deliver for you an average rate of inflation of 2 plus percent and unemployment close to full employment, and do that in a way that preserves economic stability. I think that's what we're trying to do, and I think that's eminently achievable. And we've made progress on these fronts over the past year. With the unemployment rates closer to full employment, we're a bit closer to 2 to 3% inflation, and our forecasts have us making further progress over the next year. So I wouldn't despair that we're not going to kind of deliver those outcomes for you. If we don't, then there'll be a conversation in the community at large. But that's not the central scenario.
Just got time for two more, so just one here, and then someone down the back's been very persistent with their hand up. So if we can go here first.
So where are we?
Are we going down the back first, and then we'll come here?
Thank you. Paul Dales, Chief Economist at Capital Economics. I think, Governor Lowe, the RBA were to learn from its forecast misses over the past few years, and it happens to us all, that the unemployment rate is going to continue to fall, but wages growth probably won't pick up much, and inflation probably won't pick up much. That seems to be the underlying message of your view, and that there's no need to raise interest rates, perhaps for all of next year, and maybe a bit longer. I think those trends are going to continue, and that's certainly the lesson I've seen from overseas. So I don't think inflation will force you to raise interest rates for quite some time, perhaps late 2019 or perhaps later. But the question is, what set of economic conditions would actually prompt you to raise interest rates if it wasn't inflation?
Well, we operate an inflation targeting framework, so that the core thing is inflation. If inflation stays kind of at very low levels, it's hard to see the need for significant rises in interest rates, isn't it? So
that's
possible.
That's what the Fed, the Bank of England, well, not the Bank of England, the Fed and the Bank of Canada are doing it. I just wondered if you could see a similar set of circumstances where you might raise interest rates even if inflation's low.
Well, I don't want to really go into other countries' monetary policy, but I think it is important to be clear about Canada, what happened there. They lowered interest rates twice in, it was 2015, when the oil prices were falling. They took out insurance, and now they say that their increases are to remove that insurance. And the Bank of England took out insurance after Brexit, and it's removed that insurance as well. We didn't take that extra step down that other central banks did. So there's no kind of direct correlation between what they're doing and what we're doing. There are scenarios, though, in which inflation does pick up. I think we shouldn't kind of move to a mindset of just inflation will never pick up, because that's certainly not my mindset. Producer price inflation out of China has been quite strong over the past year. Chinese export prices are rising at a stronger pace than they have for a while. And it's quite likely that in the US and some of the other countries with very low unemployment rates, that wages will start rising a bit faster than they have, and inflation will rise. And so there'll be more inflation impulse in the global system. So there are scenarios in which inflation does increase. So I think we shouldn't kind of move too quickly to just, well, we're never going to see inflation again. It would be very strange if every Western country was operating below full employment and there was no price pressures anywhere. I don't think that's going to happen. It's just taking longer to occur than it normally happened in the past. So it's a strange world where the central bank governor's hoping for higher inflation, isn't it? Well, we have an annual dinner with the governors and the ex-deputy governors of the Reserve Bank, and we had one a few months ago, and I think they look on slightly aghast at calls for higher inflation, because when they were in the positions that I've been in, their challenge was to keep inflation down, whereas the world's changed.
Just last question.
Hi, Governor. Thank you for your comments. Sarah Hunter from BIS Oxford Economics. You touched a bit on some of the structural factors that are weighing on wage growth and income growth globally. I just wondered if you could comment on what you see those factors doing to wage and income growth in the long run. How much lower are we talking about, and what the impact that's going to be on inflation going forward?
I think eventually the forces of supply and demand will win out, and wage growth will pick up. It's just taking time. You know, to the extent we've got a strategy here, my strategy has been to talk about the benefits of stronger wage growth, to put a floor under wage expectations. Earlier in the year, I kind of called for stronger wage growth publicly, and it was quite controversial. Some in the media interpreted me as saying I was kind of wanted the workers of the world to unite and rise up against the evil capitalists, and it wasn't what I was doing, but I was trying to kind of say, well, it's okay for wages to grow a bit more quickly. So we were getting into I was worried we were getting into an environment where wage expectations were falling, and that was going to be problematic. And it's hard to tell, but my sense is that wage growth has stabilised at a low level and it's not going to fall further, so that there's no longer kind of declining wage expectations. So that's been one part of the strategy. And the other is to have the economy run sufficiently fast with stimulatory monetary policy to create more and more pockets where the supply-demand balance is shifting. And we're seeing that happen now. So in some parts of construction related to the infrastructure investment, in some parts of IT, project management, IT security, and some parts of professional services, particularly in the finance field, we are seeing wages move up a bit more quickly. So where the demand and supply balance is out of alignment, wages will still adjust. So, you know, while I've got these structural factors that are having a pervasive effect, they're not going to last forever. As long as wage expectations don't fall too far, which I don't think they're going to, and we can get the supply-demand balance better, I think wage growth will gradually lift. Now, it's in our collective interest for that to happen. Because we're going to have trouble delivering you 2.5% average inflation if wage growth is 2% in Australia. We've got some productivity growth occurring. Let's say it's 1% a year, labour productivity growth and wages are growing at 2%. That does not deliver you 2.5% average inflation. So I think we'll get there. It's just a slow process and we've got to be patient. And that's been my central message for a while now. We're prepared to be patient. We're getting there, we're making progress, we're patient, and we'll continue to be patient.